Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. The show comes to you from CHI 2014, the Conference on Human Factors in Computing, or HCI, Human Computer Interaction. The annual conference, attended by about 3,000 people, academics and industry, is an interesting mix of new forms of technology, often with the first public showing of ideas that will become our gadgets in a few years. And then there are a lot of people whose interest is more in the social side of computing. What does this new technology mean for society? Bigger questions and developing approaches such as value-based design or HCI for peace or collapse informatics. Tonight's guest is John Harvey. John is a researcher at the Horizon Digital Economy Research Institute at the University of Nottingham. An economic anthropologist, John is researching systems to encourage non-monetary forms of exchange, such as FreeCycle, Couchsurfing, and his own Nihoy. He talks with us here about pro-sociality and empathy as core design strategies. So you grew up in the north of England?
That's right. That's right. I was actually born in Germany. Stayed there for a year. Moved to Northern Ireland, and then both my parents are from the northeast of England, Whitby and Southbank, just outside of Middlesbrough. So we moved back to the northeast, and I stayed there for, most of my teenage years, before I went to university in Newcastle.
And did a degree in computing, information systems?
Information systems, yeah. So I kind of stayed there for 4 years, and then I went to work for Chorus, a large steel manufacturer. Started working in the supply chain department there, got into logistics. And I got kind of fascinated by international supply chains. So we imported a lot of raw materials from all over the globe and likewise shipped finished products all over the globe as well. So kind of naturally interested in global trade. And while I was there, I did a master's in project management. And then the steel industry started to decline. I say started to decline, I think it's always been in decline really, in the northeast of England. But I decided to branch out and do a PhD. So moved to Nottingham. And that's where I am now.
But you didn't quite carry on doing supply chain work.
Yeah.
How did you make that slide?
I think I've always been interested in trade, global trade, and what it means politically. And when my job was put at risk a few years ago, I decided that I should branch out and look for something that was potentially going to lead to more opportunities. I had the opportunity to move to Scunthorpe in the UK. I don't know whether you've been to Scunthorpe. I don't know whether there'll be anybody listening from Scunthorpe. Probably not. I don't think they have radios in Scunthorpe. I decided against it and decided to move to Nottingham.
And you are in the Horizon, what's it called? The Horizon Digital Economy Research Centre.
Yeah, that's right. It's a multidisciplinary research hub. It focuses on the digital economy. It sounds very grand, but ultimately means everything and nothing. It's kind of a catch-all term for everything. It's a really, really eclectic bunch of people. They're doing some fascinating research. There's a lot of people here at the CHI conference, actually. Steve Benford, who you've interviewed previously. He actually heads up the doctoral training centre there. So I met Steve quite early on. Really, really eclectic bunch of people. artists, musicians, people interested in business, psychology, pure computer science. It's a really innovative place, and fosters quite a lot of healthy debate that you might not get in a pure department, as it were.
So, according to your website, you're interested in how technologies can empower consumer decision making.
Yeah.
How did you get to that being the focus?
Okay, I think you can probably trace a lineage from when I was involved in supply chain management. Actually, I kind of saw this emerging space where logistics seems to be fundamentally changing. I mean, the logistics of actually buying something. So at the moment, you can see all sorts of publications coming out about the sharing economy, stuff like that. I mean, I'm staying in Airbnb at the moment in Toronto. People utilising the spare resources they have, the spare idle capacity and resource, and putting it to good use. And I think that's closely related to the way supply chains will evolve over the coming decades. So I felt as though I kind of had a background in that. But I was interested in economic anthropology, ways in which people can reconceive the economic systems that they're part of. So yeah, I think it's a kind of natural intellectual lineage from working in supply chain management to understanding different ways in which people might move things or provision for them, provide for themselves.
And those systems can work either inside or, let's say outside, but maybe beside.
Yeah, definitely.
The traditional economy.
Definitely. I think what comes to mind when you think of the economy, if you were to stop anybody in the street and say economy, what comes to mind naturally are ideas of national finance, gross domestic product, inflation, interest rates, that side of calculative dimension of the economy. And I think we all know implicitly that the economy isn't just that. I mean, when we give, whenever we share, borrow, lend, take, or even steal, we do so often in the absence of the calculated reason we see in the formal economy. And the media may present a kind of dominant discourse about the market economy. And naturally, that's what we think of. So naturally, I've been interested in ideas of the informal economy as well. I think a lot of, just as much time, effort and interpersonal meaning goes into the informal economy.
So what is the main driver for the informal economy? And I know you're going to tell me there's lots of drivers.
Yeah, I think so. I'm actually going to talk about this to a certain extent in the paper today. In many disciplines, HCI in particular, there seems to be a tension between how people conceptualise the economy. So in the late 19th century, I think it was in Germany, there was this idea of the Methodenstreit or something like that. I think it means method dispute. It was between social scientists, and they were trying to work out what the economy is, what human agency is, and what social structures are, and how the two relate. And there's two fundamentally different ways that people come at it. You could say that there's a formalist approach to economics, and the kind of idea that we're all rational people, and we rationalise, economise in the presence of scarce resources. And the opposite side to that, the substantivist approach, would argue that neither of those presuppositions are true, that the idea of rationality is not universal, and also that the idea of scarcity is not necessarily universal, the kind of construct. So there's a tension between what the economy is. The formalists might say the economy is the aggregate of all individual actions, whereas the substantivists may say that the economy is simply the way that people provision and furnish for themselves. It might not necessarily be that they do try to maximise utility or whatever the formalists might say.
And that instantiates itself in things like free cycle and couch surfing and those things. How do those things develop? Do they come from just somebody had a couch and they thought, I could use that?
I think it's always existed. Informal exchange is binding. It creates ties, it creates social obligation. And it's always existed. I think there's always been this idea of alienation when it comes to exchange. So I guess you might consider some people the same as yourself or some people as other. And the people that you speak to that you might consider as the same as yourself, you might give or share things readily. Whereas the people that you think are other to you, you may not. You may want some balanced exchange. You might, could even argue that that is the primary factor which caused the emergence of money.
By alienation, are you talking about the contractor aspect to it?
Yeah, the idea that the objects in our lives are transferable, and some objects are not transferable. We can keep them. We keep them within our kin, our friends, our family. Some items we kind of see having a kind of collective ownership. So who owns the food in a fridge? For any parents listening, that's it. But the kids probably feel as though they've got a claim to that food in the fridge. And that comes from a shared mutual understanding of who we are. Whereas once we introduce this idea of otherness, we introduce at the same time the concept of debt. And that moral argument for debt, I think, causes alienable things in the world.
So is the... If I am selling out my couch, I still get to keep my couch. Is that the premise?
Yeah, it's interesting how new technology is changing the way we look at these things. How we kind of belong to multiple communities online that we wouldn't necessarily interact with otherwise. And it's fascinating because it changes the dynamics of how we procure things for our own lives. It's a fascinating area. It's kind of the intersection of a lot of different things.
We see that in the things like couch surfing, but it's also in more abstract things like Wikipedia. Well, that's sharing, but the collaborative anything, development of street mapping, for example.
Yeah, collective commons, creative commons, for instance. I mean, these forms of collective ownership are fascinating. And digital resources have the unique privilege of having a property what economists might call subtractability. So if you have an apple and you eat that apple, it's subtractable. I can't eat the apple. It sounds like a bit like you've seen There Will Be Blood. If I have your milkshake, I drink your milkshake. Yeah, there's an idea that you can take that resource and stop other people from having it. For digital resources, subtractability isn't really a problem. The only problem comes from trying to exclude people from things. So when we think of pirating music or films, we struggle to exclude it. But ultimately, the resource isn't subtractable. We can share it readily. So when that comes to knowledge and digital resources, we can kind of approach problems in novel ways when we have those resources.
But as aren't we subtracting from the value of the person that owned it to start with?
Potentially, yeah. I guess this comes back to the idea of debt. It's how you conceptualize the value of the things you own and what you think you should receive in return for the things you own.
And looking at it in terms of services rather than products, like the privilege of sleeping on I'm selling the service of sleeping on the couch, I'm not selling my couch.
Yeah. But then there's Airbnb, but there's also couch surfing as well. And that's quite interesting. That you can sell the service, or you can give it away. And these services have both been really, really successful. They've both garnered millions and millions of people and users of the service. So it's fascinating.
The difference there is, with couch surfing, you're giving it away?
You're giving it away, yeah. You could say it's a gift, or you could say it's sharing. So I'm working on a research paper that's been submitted, hopefully will be published in a few months, where we interviewed couch surfers and we tried to get to the heart of why they were using it. And ultimately I think it's why we do a lot of things is to kind of transcend ourselves, get a greater sense of social self. Whereas the sharing economy, I read an article the other day that was quite cynical of it. And it was talking about the sharing economy as being Airbnb rather than couchsurfing. And it said the primary motivator isn't trust. It isn't being kind to people. This is, they're driven by desperation. They're trying to monetize the things they have, squeeze the value because of the political structure around them. And you can look at that one of a variety of ways, I guess, depending on where you see it from.
And in the couch surfing example, you're valuing something else. You're valuing the social interaction.
Yeah,
you're getting to meet people.
The presence. I actually interviewed a man in Nottingham, and he had a mansion. It was so big, massive, wonderful, beautiful house, full of beautiful artwork, giant grand pianos. But he was lonely. I think he was about 65. He's homosexual. I don't know whether that played into it, because he found it difficult to go out and meet homosexual men of similar age. And as a consequence, he felt lonely. And a lot of people are cynical of couch surfing and say, well, actually, it's kind of a pickup service. So I asked him about that and said, well, do you use it? And he said, well, no, generally, the people who come stay with me are couples. So the social environment in which he was living in contributed to his feeling of loneliness, but that the technology helped him to escape that sense of loneliness. He never surfed on anybody else's couch, but he hosted hundreds of people. I think that's a beautiful thing to do. He transcended this sense of loneliness by helping people.
Does that not undermine the actual economy? If you owned a guest house near where that guy lives.
Well, that's it. I mean, when you said undermine the economy, I think what that statement might presuppose is that the economy is progressing. And that is potentially a controversial thing to say. Should the economy progress, and what does progress look like? It might sound trite to say something like that. But,
do we need it to grow?
Personally, I think growth is a fallacy. I do. I read a brilliant book by a guy called Tim Jackson, and he called it Prosperity Without Growth. I think infinite economic growth on a finite planet is, I don't know, it seems to me as a fallacy. So really, we should be designing economic policy that helps people to feel well-being rather than increase GDP. I think GDP is a terrible measure of prosperity.
So why are we so obsessed by it?
Why are we so obsessed?
Yeah. It's hard to turn on a news report and not hear them talk in some form about how some decision or something is affecting growth positively or negatively.
Yeah, well, it comes down to ideas about morality, I think. And it also comes down to, without getting too deep, potentially philosophy of mind. Very much utilitarian thinking about who we are as individuals and what we should do as individuals. The free market, certainly in North America and in Europe, has helped to liberate people, but potentially it imprisons them in an iron cage of consumption at the same time.
And the technologies that we have developed form those bars.
Yeah, I think, well, consumerism is rampant, isn't it?
But we need to buy stuff.
Yeah, we do. And we need to be interested. I mean, that's just play, isn't it? It's who we are. We want novelty. I think that's kind of a universal human feature. Maybe it's not. But in my own personal anecdotal experience, I'd say it probably is.
The systems we're building, the IT systems, the banking systems, the project management systems, the big focus in the last few years has been efficiency.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Again, I mean, this comes down to your own moral stance, doesn't it? Personally, I think efficiency, as it relates to the consumption of resources, is a good thing. I mean, the less damage we can do to the planet, the less resources that we can extract, the better. I think most people probably agree with that, irrespective of political affiliation. I think that seems to be quite a universal trait. Efficiency as it comes to production, like, starts to become controversial. As you put efficient tools of production into the hands of the few, then potentially you reduce the available workforce. There are obviously implications there, but yeah.
Well, it might not be a good thing for the north of England that the shipbuilding has moved to China.
Yeah.
In terms of scalability of systems, is it a good thing that they've been able to essentially centralize that entire industry?
It's an interesting one. It's full of conundrums. It depends on how globalized you want the world to be. If you want decentralization, if you want nations that can self-sustain, then it's difficult to justify shipping an entire industry to a different continent. Although nowadays, when you look at steelmaking in the UK, for instance, iron ore isn't really taken from the UK. It's taken from South America, Australia, other places like that, as with coal. So it seems crazy to ship it from one continent to another, manufacture a product, and then ship it to a different continent. It's a lot of transportation for one raw product that somebody else can use. So from the perspective of sustainability, you kind of think, well, that's potentially wrong. But at the same time, it may have knock-on effects for the sustainability of a nation's economy. I don't think there's an easy answer.
You have developed a company, organisation.
That's right.
Nihoy.
That's right.
Where did you get that name from?
It's a bit daft, really. It's a portmanteau, so two words that have been blended together, of two slang words from the northeast of England. So, ni is no, hoy is throw. It's, yeah, a bit daft. But the idea to start with was a bit daft. We kind of thought, well, we loved Freecycle, and that's the stuff that we were doing. Freegal in the UK, similarly, has had a great impact on getting households to reuse their old things, giving them away. But the thing is that these companies, or these organisations rather, aren't companies. So they don't get a lot of investment. They don't make a profit, so they don't reinvest it in the technology. They don't make it easier and more efficient for people to use it. And we were in a situation where I was working with a lot of computer scientists who were confident enough that they could try to create something new. So what we did was went away and we created a kind of mobile version of the app.
I'm sorry, but we've skipped what it actually does.
Yeah, sorry. So we developed a kind of similar thing to Freecycle as a mobile application. And we decided to kind of just give it away and see what happened. And what happened when we did that was that an environmental consultant approached us and said that the technology should be used in organisations. And we kind of thought about it, but we weren't that interested in making money. We kind of did it because we thought it was a nice idea. But over the last 6 months or so, we developed the existing technology that we took for the application. And we redesigned it for two large NHS trusts in the UK.
And so Freecycle is not using my bike anymore. Does anyone want it?
Yeah, precisely. Or can't you get all sorts on it.
Yeah, or whatever it might
sofas, be. Sofas, pianos, stuff like that. Yeah. You advertise it, someone comes and picks it up. So one of the organisations that took our product on were a health trust. And they kind of took a similar approach to Freecycle. He said, we just want anybody in the organisation to advertise stuff that they don't need.
Within the organisation?
Within the organisation, yeah. And that's live, and we're trialling that at the moment. But
so you've expanded that into the hospitals?
Yeah, so we started the project again with a second trust, a health trust in the UK, so 10,000 employees. And what they've done is really, really ambitious. They've they've taken the idea of what FreeCycle is, about reusing the things in our lives, and they've decided to use it as a kind of asset management system. So all of the pieces of furniture within an organisation with 10,000 employees, it's a hell of a lot of furniture, a lot of chairs, a lot of desks, cupboards, stuff like that. What they've done is add a barcode, unique barcodes to everything they own. And then they've said, well, where is it and who owns it? So now, whenever an employee wants new furniture, they go into the system and say, I need a new chair. And the system points them in a direction of a chair that's not in use. And that's trialling at the moment. And I think the real innovation there isn't the technology, it's the policy, it's the decision to say, we can do something new here that hasn't been done before. And it's quite radical, I think, to implement something like that. Most of the asset management systems in large companies tend to focus on resources of really, really high value. So when I worked at Chorus, for instance, talking equipment that's worth millions of pounds. But for a lot of organisations, there are millions of pounds tied up in furniture. The health trust that we're working with, for instance, have millions of pounds of furniture. Much of it is sat dormant, idle, not doing anything. And if we can even reduce that by a fraction, then the organisation is not only saving money, which in the UK is a great thing for the taxpayer, it's also a great thing for the environment. It's a challenge, I think it's a prototype at the moment, so we'll see how it goes. But
and you're doing that, carrying on gifting that work, your work?
Well, my PhD work is kind of, I guess, slightly related. I'm interested in economic anthropology, why people give and share things with one another. But as it comes to the organisation, I think you enter into different social arrangements, don't you? Once you're in the realm of the institution, the kind of rules that govern the institution are different from what you might do in your own personal life with your friends and family. But still, yeah, it's interesting to see that there's a bit of crossover there.
Because I can see I can see why you'd want to help a hospital. Because it's helping society, yeah. It's helping health, that sort of stuff. Would you do the same thing for a company?
Yeah, definitely. We're at a stage now where we're assessing the best way to implement the system, so it's at the prototype stage, but we're already seeing the benefits even at this early stage. People using the system and enjoying it, finding that they can actually use it properly, which is really, really encouraging. It means that other large organisations that have a lot of resources that aren't being used, and it doesn't necessarily need to be furniture; it could be anything that the company owns that multiple people need to have access to at any given time.
Yeah, I was thinking more of the, I'm not going to slip and use the word sustainability, because that's that, if you read about sustainability in the open source community, they're all talking about how is this the business model of the open source community.
Yeah.
So, is there a viable business model for you in doing that work? I mean, you're in the privileged position of doing it as a researcher.
Well, I mean, it's kind of separate from my research. We are a business, we are a functioning business, we are a social enterprise. We did think about setting up as a social enterprise, but we thought long and hard about it, and we thought the best way for us to realise our ambitions, the best vehicle to implement change is a company. But it has ethical associations with it you need to consider. But we'd happily help other companies to develop it. I mean, this isn't a sales pitch, but if there are people who are listening that wanted to do that, we'd be happy to speak to them.
Are there companies you wouldn't give it to? Or wouldn't work with?
I don't know.
Cigarette company.
I mean, if the North Korean government knocked on the door, we might say no, but I don't know. I mean, cigarette companies need chairs and tables just like anybody else. I'm not going to say we're going to take a moral stance on smoking. I don't smoke, but I know plenty of people that do. I drink heavily. I would happily sell it to a brewery.
I was just wondering about where the sociality kicks in.
I think It's quite a nuanced debate. If you're talking about introducing a system for a company to reuse furniture, then people will be quite cynical about whether that is pro-social or not. It's kind of saving money for a company. And even some might call it greenwashing. I mean, I don't think it is greenwashing. I think it is, you can see a tangible effect that isn't otherwise possible. It's a nuanced debate. I don't think framing it in terms of pro-sociality is necessary, really. If you do, it starts to become quite complex. Certainly improves sustainability.
So what does pro-sociality mean to you?
Pro-sociality to me means a voluntary, intentional behaviour that results in benefits for another. That's the definition that I would use.
Let's unpack that. It's voluntary.
Yeah. It's intentional.
Intentional.
And it results in benefits from another. So.
And you're right. It's hard to justify that in a rational economic approach. Within the rational approach, how would they justify you doing that work? Pro-social.
I find the area really, really fascinating. So if you think about mainstream economics, there's a lot of theory within economics that tries to explain away what altruism is, what kindness is, what pro-sociality is. And there are lots of different ways that it tries to do that, but ultimately at the core is this idea of a utilitarian self. So, for instance, they may say, if you act in a way that is kind to other people, you get a sense of a warm glow, you feel good about yourself. So they explain it away and say, well, you feel good, so that's why you do it, it's selfish. Or similarly, they'll say, when you see somebody in distress, you feel negative, you're associated, and you feel guilt. And they would say, when you act in a kind manner towards other people, that is helping you to relieve the sense of guilt that you feel. Alternatively to that utilitarian conception of what altruism is, that egoistic interpretation, our ideas about empathic concerns or empathy and the ability to imagine the other, imagine the what other people perceive and endure in their own lives. And that raises, again, kind of deep questions about philosophy of mind. And it cuts right to the heart of the differences between economics and anthropology.
So does that lend itself to design strategies?
I think it does. You see, I've noticed a lot of work in behavioural economics at the moment, particularly within HCI, which attempts to kind of nudge behaviour. It takes an individual at worst to be irrational, but within confines, they say, with bounded rationality. And what they attempt to do is nudge people. So HCI is in a great position where it can present information, it can present cues to people and try to manipulate their behaviour. But that need not be the case. It might be that you develop a tool and give it to someone. Or you develop a tool in participation with a culture that may not be your own. So, there are two ways of coming at it. I mean, there's the cynic of that other approach of giving tools to people. You know, that argument of giving a man a fishing rod rather than a fish. You could say, well, ultimately that is a kind of sublimated social goal. By giving him that fishing rod, you advocate in fishing. Whether that leads to, I don't know, overfishing or anything else, destruction of the ecosystem. There's two different ways of coming at it, and both have got real deep moral implications.
Are you familiar with Bran Knowles' work from Lancaster?
I'm not sure I am.
No. She just finished her PhD, and it's on sustainable HCI. Her premise is that is very similar to what you've just been saying, that the by appealing to people's rational behaviour, giving people the selfish justification. So if you do this thing, you're also going to save money.
Yeah.
It's actually doing sustainability a disservice.
Yeah.
Because it's valuing the stuff that is the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and so that's a really, really important point. That idea of apples and oranges, that incommensurability, I think you can probably call it, is, it gets to the heart of what culture is. How we value things, and I think it's one of the primary criticisms of Western economics that anthropologists would level at economists. How you value something can change. It differs between cultures. So trying to apply the same rigid arguments about who we are as people to different cultures is difficult.
So in terms of applying this, it doesn't sound like this is something that could apply at the level of you've been asked to make a website for a company. It's not going to have a lot of effect at that level.
Mm.
It will be more about the level of helping develop a business model.
I think it's difficult to tell the local effects of each.
But if you were to be helping a shipping company with its logistics or supply chain or something, taking this pro-social, this empathy as the core for the design strategies, it's not going to have a lot of effect. But if you're thinking about how they might structure their business, it might.
Hmm. Yeah. The political organisation of a company, if it was based around principles of empathy rather than utilitarian thinking, that's a really interesting avenue. I don't know many companies that have taken that explicit stance, but it could be a fascinating avenue for research, I guess.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
In the presentation I'm about to give, I have a quote at the start, and it's from a panel discussion a couple of years ago, and in it they say that HCI is an interventionary field. It doesn't try to describe or interpret the world, it tries to actually change it. And if we take that definition to be true, then it's inescapably an activist discipline. So I think there is a moral obligation of HCI researchers to consider the impact, the interpersonal impact of their own research.
If we're actively changing the world for the better, what do you think that needs changing?
I think I'm quite naturally anarchistic in my thinking. So I like decentralisation. I like giving the tools to people so that they can do something meaningful with their life. As I mentioned before, unless those tools are created in participation with local cultures, though, then you run the risk of cultural imperialism. So I think the CHI community itself is already grasping with these issues, and I think they're being pretty successful so far in teasing out what are the important things that matter. I like the idea of decentralisation. I like the idea that technology can, don't want to say liberate, but help people to become kinder, freer.
So what does the anarchistic economist, I don't know if you describe yourself as that, but I just wrote those two words down beside each other and it looked like a good description.
I don't know whether I would describe myself as an economist, to be honest. I feel like more of an anthropologist. I'm more interested in difference in the world than I am with universal principles. And I think that's the beauty of anthropology. It's that it reminds us that there is a lot of difference in the world, and when we try to rely on universal principles, it's difficult.
Okay, I'll cross off economist or anthropologist instead. So, what challenges do you have for the next couple of years?
I don't know. Same challenges as everybody else, I guess. Let's find a permanent job at the end of the year. think the likelihood is I'll try to stay in academia in some fashion. But the grand scheme of things, I don't know. Continue the same line of thought, hopefully.
How much is your thesis written?
It's almost complete. It's almost complete. Whether it's any good or not is a different matter, but, yeah.
What's the last line? Either it is or it's going to be.
Yeah, the last line is not written yet. I tell you what, there's a good George Bernard Shaw quote. And he says that if all the economists in the world were laid end to end, they still wouldn't reach a conclusion.
What you're going to say? It would be a good thing.
Yeah, put up against the wall. Fired at.
But do you have a take-home message from your research?
I'm working with a charity in London at the moment called Street Bank. And they're a social networking service that help people to give and share their belongings. And one thing that I found analysing their organisation is that the behaviour is what I would call autotelic. And what I mean by that word autotelic is that when I've analysed the network and looked at the behaviour of individuals, it doesn't really depend on reciprocity. And what I mean by that is, if you give something to somebody, they don't necessarily have to give it back. But it's also not indirect reciprocity either. So if Mr. A gives to Mr. B, and Mr. B gives to Mr. C, and Mr. C gives to Mr. A, we could call that indirect reciprocity. We could say there's some balance there in the network. But what I'm actually finding is that it's actually Mr. A gives to Mr. B, gives to Mr. C, gives to Mr. D, and so on.
And it never actually gets back to A?
It comes back occasionally, just because of the amount of people that are doing it, but the vast majority of it, it's not premised on reciprocity. And that's a really, really beautiful thought, to think that a small charity can introduce some HCI into the world and encourage people to act in a kinder way towards other people. I think that's a really, really beautiful thought.
Is it the same as the pay it forward notions?
It's interesting because sometimes the gifts happen between people in different positions in society. So, pay it forward sounds as if, well, if in just the word pay, I mean that involves money, which involves debt, it's a moral stance. It's more like play. It's more like play than pay. I might write that down, actually. It's done for the sake of enjoyment, almost. And that, I mean, if you can create an economy based on that, that's clearly utopian principles that is not likely to happen. But yeah, it's a nice thought.
What would we have to change in the system to make that happen?
I don't think it will entirely change. I think we necessarily need both sides of the economy. I think there needs to be a redress in the balance between those two sides. And hopefully there will be brilliant organisations like that.
Do you have any advice for listeners? Or anything that you'd really like to see them do?
Be willing to fail, I guess. Be willing to fail. If you're going to work as an activist on small projects, then don't take failure as the end of the road. I mean, there's so much to learn from failure that it's almost virtuous. It's better than doing nothing.
I'm writing that down. Fantastic. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, you too.
Sustainable Lens on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mayer. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz and podcast on sustainablelands.org, where we are building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch. You can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.